hands raised, was trying to edge past us from the narrow doorway to the path. "Sorry," she said, "I just need to..." Sam released me quite abruptly and walked away with long strides, his shoulders hunched and rigid, just pausing as the gate opened. He didn't look back.
"Is that our trainer's new bloke arriving?"
said Mum behind me. She was wrenching off her apron and straightening her hair in one fluid movement. "I thought he was coming at 4. I haven't even put my lippy on. Are you all right?" Trina turned, and through the blur of my tears I could just make out her face as she gave a small, hopeful smile. "Mum, Dad, this is Eddie," she said. And a slim black woman in a short, flowery dress gave us a hesitant wave. Chapter 19. As it turns out, as a distraction from losing the second great love of your life, I can highly recommend your sister coming out on Christmas Day, especially with a young woman of colour called Edwina. Mum covered her initial shock with a flurry of over-effusive welcomes and the promise of tea-making, shepherding Eddie and Trina into the living room, pausing momentarily to give me a look that, if my mother had been the type to swear, would have said, "WTF," before she slipped back down the corridor to the kitchen. Tom emerged from the living room, yelled, "Eddie!" gave our guest a huge hug, waited on jiggly feet to be handed his present, and ripped it apart, then ran off with a new Lego set. And Dad, utterly silenced, simply stared at what was unfolding before him, like someone dumped into a hallucinogenic dream. I saw Trina's uncharacteristically anxious expression, felt the rising sense of panic in the air, and knew I had to act. I murmured at Dad to close his mouth, then stepped forward and held out my hand. "Eddie," I said. "Hi, I'm Louisa. My sister will no doubt have told you all the bad stuff." "Actually," Eddie said, "she's only told me wonderful things. You live in New York, don't you?" "Mostly." I hoped my smile didn't look as forced as it felt. "I lived in Brooklyn for 2 years after I left college. I still miss it." She shed her bronze-coloured coat, waiting while Trina wedged it onto our overstacked pegs. She was tiny, a porcelain doll, with the most exquisitely symmetrical features I'd ever seen, and eyes that slanted upwards with extravagant black lashes. She chatted away as we went into the living room, perhaps too polite to acknowledge my parents' barely concealed shock, and stooped to shake hands with Grandad, who smiled his lopsided smile at her, then went back to staring at the television. I had never seen my sister like this. It was as if we had just been introduced to two strangers rather than one. There was Eddie, impeccably polite, interesting, engaged, steering us with grace through these choppy, controversial waters. And then there was new Trina, her expression faintly unsure, her smile a little fragile, her hand occasionally reaching across the sofa to squeeze her girlfriend's as if for reassurance. Dad's jaw dropped a full 3 inches the first time she did it, and Mum jabbed his rib repeatedly with her elbow until he closed it again. "So, Edwina," said Mum, pouring the tea, "Trina's told us so little about you. How did you two meet?" Eddie smiled. "I run an interior shop near Katrina's flat, and she just popped in a few times to get cushions and fabric, and we started talking. We went for a drink, and later to the cinema, and, you know, it turned out we had a lot in common." I found myself nodding, trying to work out what my sister could possibly have in common with this polished, elegant creature in front of me. "Things in common. How lovely. Things in common are a great thing. Yes. And where is it you come... Oh, goodness, I don't mean... Where do I come from?" "Blackheath." "I know, people rarely move to North London from South. My parents moved to Boreham Wood when they retired 3 years ago, so I'm one of those rarities, a North and South Londoner." She beamed at Trina, as if this was some shared joke, before turning back to Mum. "Have you always lived around here?"
"Mum and Dad will leave Stortford in their coffins," Trina said.
"Not too soon, we hope," I said. "It looks like a beautiful town. I can see why you'd want to stay," Eddie said, holding up her plate. "This cake is amazing, Mrs. Clark. Do you make it yourself? My mother makes one with rum, and she swears you have to steep the fruit for 3 months to get the full flavour."
"Katrina is gay," said Dad.
"It's good, Mum," said Trina. "The sultanas are really moist." Dad looked from one of us to the other.
"Oh, Trina likes girls. And nobody's saying anything." and just wanging on about fecking cushions and cake.
Bernard, said my mother.
Perhaps I should give you all a moment, said Eddie.
No, stay, Eddie.
Trina glanced at Tom, who was engrossed in the television, and said, Yes, Dad, I like women. Or at least, I like Eddie.
Trina might be gender fluid, said Mum nervously. Is that the right expression? The young people at night school tell me a lot of them are neither one thing nor the other these days. There's a spectrum, or speculum. I can never remember which.
Dad blinked. Mum swallowed a gulp of tea so audibly that it was almost painful.
Well, personally, I said when Trina had stopped patting her on the back, I just think it's great that anyone would want to go out with Trina. Anyone at all. You know, anyone with eyes and ears and a heart and stuff.
Trina shot me a look of genuine gratitude.
You always did wear jeans a lot, growing up,
Mum mused, wiping her mouth.
Perhaps I should have made you wear more dresses.
It's got nothing to do with jeans, Mum.
Jeans, maybe. Well, it certainly doesn't run in our family, said Dad. No offence, Edwina.
None taken, Mr. Clark.
I'm gay, Dad. I'm gay, and I'm happier than I've ever been, and it's really none of anyone else's business how I choose to be happy. But I'd really like it if you and Mum could be happy for me, because I am. And more importantly, I'm hoping that Eddie will be in my and Tom's lives for a very long time.
She glanced over at Eddie, who smiled reassuringly. There was a long silence.
You've never said anything, said Dad accusingly. You never acted gay.
How's a gay person supposed to act? Trina said.
Well, gay. Like, you've never brought home a girl before.
I've never brought home anyone before, apart from Sandeep, that accountant, and you didn't like him because he didn't like football.
I like football, said Eddie helpfully.
Dad sat and stared at his plate. Finally he sighed and rubbed his eyes with both palms. When he stopped, his whole face seemed dazed, like someone woken abruptly from sleep. Mum was watching him intently, anxiety writ large across her face.
Eddie. Edwina. I'm sorry if I'm coming across as an old fart. I'm not a homophobic, really, but...
Oh, God, said Trina. There's a but. Dad shook his head.
But I'll probably say the wrong thing anyway and cause all sorts of offence because I'm just an old fella who doesn't understand all the new lingo and the way things are done. My wife will tell you that. All this being said, even I know that all that matters in the long run is that these two girls of mine are happy. And if you make her happy, Eddie, like Sam makes our Lou happy, then good on you. I'm very glad to know you.
He stood and reached a hand across the coffee table, and after a moment, Eddie leant forward and shook it.
Right. Now let's have a bit of that cake.
Mum gave a little sigh of relief and reached for the knife. And I did the best I could to smile, then hurriedly left the room. There is a definite hierarchy to heartbreak. I worked it out. Top of the list is the death of the person you love. There is no situation likely to elicit more shock and outright sympathy. Faces will fall, a caring hand reach out to squeeze your shoulder. Oh, God, I'm so sorry. After that, it's probably being left for someone else. The betrayal. The wickedness of the two people concerned bringing forth affirmations of outrage, of solidarity. Oh, that must have been such a shock for you. You could add forced separation, religious obstacles, serious illness. But we drifted apart because we were living on separate continents is, while true, unlikely to prompt more than a nod of acknowledgement, a pragmatic shrug of understanding. Yeah, these things happen. I saw that reaction, albeit dressed up in maternal concern, in my mother's response to my news, and then my father's.
Well, that's an awful shame, but I suppose it's not a huge surprise.
And felt faintly stung, in a way I couldn't express.
What do you mean, not a huge surprise? I loved him!
Boxing Day slid by slowly, the hours turgid and sad. I slept fitfully, glad of the distraction that Eddie created, so that I didn't have to be the focus of attention. I lay in the bath and on the bed in the little box room, wiped away the odd tear and hoped nobody would notice. Mum brought me tea and tried not to talk too much about the radiant happiness of my sister. And it was lovely to see, or it would have been, had I not been so heartbroken. I watched the two of them surreptitiously holding hands under the table while Mum served supper, their heads bent together while they discussed something in a magazine, their feet touching as they watched television, Tom wedging his way between them with the confidence of the utterly loved, indifferent to who was doing the loving. Once we were past the huge surprise, it made perfect sense to me. Trina was so happy, relaxed in this woman's company in a way I had never seen. Occasionally she would cast me fleeting glances that were shy and quietly triumphant, and I would smile back, hoping it didn't look as fake as it felt. Because all I felt was a second gigantic hole where my heart had been. Without the anger that had fueled me for the past 48 hours, I was a void. Sam had gone, and I had as good as sent him away. To other people, the end of my relationship might have been comprehensible, but to me, it somehow made no sense at all. On Boxing Day afternoon, my family dozed on the sofa. I had forgotten how much time in our household was spent either discussing, eating, or digesting food. I roused myself and walked to Storkville Castle. It was empty, bar a brisk woman in a wind cheetah with her dog. She nodded hello in a way that suggested she wanted no part in any further conversation, and I made my way up the ramparts and onto a bench where I could look out over the maze and the southern half of Storkville. I let the stiff breeze sting the tips of my ears and my feet grow cold, and I told myself that I wouldn't always feel so sad. I let myself think about Will, and how many afternoons we had spent around this castle, and how I had survived his death, and I told myself firmly that this new pain was a lesser one. I was not facing months of sadness so deep it made me feel nauseous. I would not think about Sam. I would not think about him with that woman. I would not look at Facebook. I would return to my exciting, eventful, rich new life in New York, and once I was fully away from him, the parts of me that felt scorched, destroyed, would eventually heal. Perhaps we had not been the thing I thought we were. Perhaps the intensity of our first meeting, who could resist a paramedic after all, had made us believe the intensity was ours. Maybe I just needed someone to stop me grieving. Maybe it had been a rebound relationship and I would feel better sooner than I thought. I told myself this over and over again, but some part of me stubbornly refused to listen. And finally, when I got tired of pretending it was all going to be fine, I closed my eyes, put my head into my hands, and I cried. At an empty castle, on a day when everyone else was at home, I let grief course through me, and I sobbed without inhibition or fear of discovery. I cried in a way that I couldn't cry in the little house in Renfrew Road, and wouldn't be able to once I got back to the Gopniks, with anger and sadness, a kind of emotional bloodletting. "You fecker," I sobbed into my knees. "I was only gone 3 months." My voice sounded strange, strangled, and like Tom, who used to look at his own reflection deliberately when crying, and then cry even harder. The sound of those words was so sad and horribly final that I made myself cry even harder. "Damn you, Sam. Damn you for making me think it was worth the risk." "So, can I sit down too, or is this like a private grief fest?" My head shot up. In front of me stood Lily, wrapped in a huge black parka and a red scarf, her arms folded over her chest, looking as if she might have been standing there, studying me for some time. She grinned, as if somehow the sight of me in my darkest hour was actually quite amusing, then waited while I pulled myself together. "Well, I guess I don't need to ask what's going on in your life," she said, and punched me hard in the arm. "How did you know I was here?" "I walked round to your house to say hi, as I've been home from skiing 2 days, and you haven't even bothered to call." "I'm sorry," I said. It's been hard because you got dumped by Sexy Sam." "Was it that blonde witch?" I blew my nose and stared at her. "I had a few days in London before Christmas, so I went to the ambulance station to say hi, and she was there, hanging off him like some kind of human mildew." I sniffed. "You could tell." "God, yes. I was going to warn you, but then I thought, what's the point? It's not like you could do anything about it from New York. Ugh, men are so stupid, though. How could he not see through that?" "Oh, Lily, I have missed you." I hadn't known quite how much until that moment. Will's daughter, in all her mercurial teenage glory. She sat down beside me, and I leant against her, as if she were the adult. We gazed into the distance. I could just make out Will's home, Grantchester House. I mean, just because she's pretty and has huge tits and one of those porny mouths that look like they're all about the blowjobs. Okay, you can stop now. Anyway, I wouldn't cry any more if I were you, she said sagely. One, no man is worth it. Even Katy Perry will tell you that. But also, your eyes go really, really small when you cry, like Microsoft kind of small. I couldn't help but laugh. She stood up and held out a hand. Come on, let's walk down to yours. There's nowhere open on Boxing Day, and Grandpa and Della and the baby that can do no wrong are doing my head in. I've got a whole 24 more hours to kill before Granny comes to pick me up. Ugh. Did you get snail trails on my jacket? You did! Oh, you are totally wiping that off! Over tea at our house, Lily filled me in on the news her emails hadn't covered. How she loved her new school, but hadn't quite got to grips with the work as she was meant to. Turns out, missing loads of school does have an effect, which is actually quite irritating on the adult I-told-you-so front. She enjoyed living with her grandmother so much that she felt able to bitch about her in the way that Lily did about people she truly loved, with humour and a kind of cheerful sarcasm. Granny was so unreasonable about her painting the walls of her room black, and she wouldn't let her drive the car, even though Lily totally knew how to drive and just wanted to get ahead before she could start lessons. It was when she was talking about her own mother that her upbeat demeanour finally fell away. Lily's mother had finally left her stepfather, of course, but the architect down the road whom she had planned to make her next husband had not played ball, refusing to leave his wife. Her mother was now living a life of hysterical misery in rented accommodation in Holland Park, with the twins and making her way through a succession of Filipina nannies who, despite an astonishing level of tolerance, were rarely tolerant enough to survive Tanya Horton Miller for more than a couple of weeks. "I never thought I'd feel sorry for the boys, but I do," she said. "Oh, I really want a cigarette. I only ever want one when I'm talking about my mum. You don't have to be Freud to work that out, right?" "I'm sorry, Lily."
"Don't be, I'm fine. I'm with Granny and at school. My mother's drama doesn't really touch me anymore."
"Well, she leaves long messages on my voicemail, weeping or telling me I'm selfish for not moving back to be with her. But I don't care." She shuddered briefly. "Sometimes I think if I stayed there, I would have gone completely mental."
I thought back to the figure who had appeared on my doorstep all those months ago, drunk, unhappy, isolated, and felt a brief burst of quiet pleasure that by taking her in, I had helped Will's daughter build this happy relationship with her grandmother. Mum came in and out, replenishing the tray with cuts of ham, cheese and warmed mince pies, and seemed delighted that Lily was there, especially when Lily, her mouth full, gave her the full rundown on the goings-on in the big house. Lily didn't think Mr. Traynor was very happy. Della, his new wife, was finding motherhood a challenge, and fussed over the baby incessantly, flinching and weeping whenever it squawked, which was basically all the time. Grandpa spends most of his time in his study, which just makes her even crosser. But when he tries to help, she just shouts at him and tells him he's doing everything wrong. "Stephen, don't hold her like that! Stephen, you've got that matinee jacket completely back to front!" "I'd tell her to do one, but he's too nice." "He's the generation that would have had very little to do with babies," Mum said kindly. "I don't think your father would have changed a single nappy." "He always asks after Granny, so I told him she had a new man."
"Mrs. Traynor has a boyfriend."
My mother's eyes rounded like saucers.
"No, of course she doesn't. Granny says she's enjoying her freedom.
But he doesn't need to know that, does he? I told Grandpa that a silver fox with an Aston Martin and all his own hair comes to take her out twice a week, and I don't know his name, but it's nice to see Granny looking so happy again. I can tell he really wants to ask questions, but he doesn't dare while Della's there, so he just nods and smiles this really fake smile and says, 'Very good,' and goes off to his study again."
"Lily," said my mother, "she can't tell lies like that."
"Why not?"
"Because, well, it's not true.
Loads of things in life aren't true.
Father Christmas isn't true, but I bet you told Tom about him anyway."
"Grandpa's got someone else.
It's good for him and for Granny, if he thinks she's having lovely mini breaks in Paris with a hot rich pensioner. And they never speak to each other, so what's the harm?"
As logic went, it was pretty impressive. I could tell because Mum's mouth was working like someone feeling a loose tooth, but she couldn't come up with any other reason why Lily was wrong.
"Anyway," said Lily, "I better get back. Family dinner, ho, ho, ho."
It was at this moment that Trina and Eddie walked in, having been out to play in the park with Tom. I saw Mum's sudden look of barely concealed anxiety and thought, "Oh, Lily, don't say anything awful." I gestured towards them. "This is Lily, Eddie, Eddie, Lily. Lily is the daughter of my old employer. Will, Eddie is my girlfriend," said Trina. "Oh, nice." Lily shook Eddie's hand, then turned back to me. "So, I'm still planning on making Granny bring me out to New York. She says she won't do it while it's this cold, but she will in the spring. So be prepared to take a few days off. April totally qualifies as spring, yeah? Up for it?"
"Can't wait," I said. To the side of me, Mum deflated quietly with relief. Lily hugged me hard, then ran from the front step. I watched her go and envied the robustness of the young.
Chapter 20. From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com to Katrina Clark at scottsherwinbarker.com.
"Great picture, Trine. Really lovely. I liked it almost as much as the four you sent yesterday. No, my favourite is still the one you sent Tuesday, the three of you at the park."
"Yes, Eddie has got really nice eyes. You definitely look happy. I'm really glad.
Re your other point, I do think it might be a little early to frame one and send it to Mum and Dad, but hey, you know best. Love to Tomo. L. Kiss. P.S. I'm fine. Thanks for asking."
I arrived back in the kind of New York blizzard that you see on the news, where only the tops of cars are visible and children sledge down normally traffic-filled streets, and even the weather forecasters can't hide their childish glee. The wide avenues were clear, forced into compliance by the mayor, the city's huge snowplows chugging dutifully up and down the major thoroughfares like gigantic beasts of burden. I might normally have been thrilled to see snow like that, but my personal weather front was grey and damp, and it hung over me like a chill weight, sucking the joy from any situation. I had never had my heart broken before, at least not by someone living. I had walked away from Patrick knowing deep down that, for both of us, our relationship had become a habit, a pair of shoes you might not really love, but wore because you couldn't be bothered to get new ones. When Will had died, I had thought I would never feel anything again. It turned out there was little comfort to be had in knowing the person you'd loved and lost was still breathing. My brain, sadistic organ that it was, insisted on returning to Sam again and again throughout my day. What was he doing now? What was he thinking? Was he with her? Did he regret what had passed between us? Had he thought of me at all? I had a dozen silent arguments with him a day, some of which I even won. My rational self would butt in, telling me there was no point in thinking about him. What was done was done. I had returned to a different continent. Our futures lay thousands of miles apart. And then, occasionally, a slightly manic self would intervene with a kind of forced optimism. I could be whoever I wanted. I was tied to nobody. I could go anywhere in the world without feeling conflicted. These three selves could jostle for space in my mind over a few minutes, and frequently did. It was a kind of schizophrenic existence, and completely exhausting. I drowned them. I ran with George and Agnes at dawn, not slowing when my chest hurt and my shins felt like hot pokers. I whizzed around the apartment, anticipating Agnes's needs, offering to help Michael when he looked particularly overworked, peeling potatoes alongside Ilaria, and ignoring her when she harrumphed. I even offered to help Ashok shovel snow off the walkway, anything to stop me having to sit and contemplate my own life. He pulled a face and told me not to be a crazy person. Did I want to see him out of a job? Josh texted me on my third day home, while Agnes was holding up individual shoes in a children's shop and talking in Polish to her mother on the phone, apparently trying to work out which size she should be purchasing and whether her sister would approve. I felt my phone vibrate and looked down.
"Hey, Louisa Clark, the first. Long time no hear. Hope you had a good Christmas. Want to grab coffee sometime?"
I stared. I had no reason not to, but somehow it felt wrong. I was too raw, my senses still full of a man 3,000 miles away.
"Hey, Josh. Busy right now. Agnes runs me off my feet. But maybe sometime soon. Hope you're well. L. Kiss."
He didn't respond, and I felt strangely bad about it. Gary loaded Agnes's shopping bags into the car, and then her phone buzzed. She pulled it from her bag and stared at it. She looked out of the window for a moment, then at me.
"I forgot I had an art lesson. We have to go to East Williamsburg."
It was patently a lie. I had a sudden memory of the awful Thanksgiving lunch, with all its revelations, and tried not to let it show on my face.
I'll cancel the piano lesson then, I said evenly.
Yes, Gary, I have art lesson, I forgot.
Without a word, Gary pulled the limo onto the road. Gary and I sat in silence in the car park, the engine running quietly to protect us from the chill outside. I felt quietly furious with Agnes for choosing this afternoon for one of her art lessons, as it meant I was left alone with my thoughts, a bunch of unwelcome house guests who refused to leave. I put my earphones in and played myself some cheerful music. I used my iPad to organise the rest of Agnes's week. I played 3 online Scrabble moves with Mum. I answered an email from Trina, asking whether I thought she should take Eddie to a work dinner or if it was too soon. I thought she should probably just get on with it. I gazed outside at the glowering, snow-laden sky and wondered if more was going to fall. Gary watched a comedy on his tablet, snorting alongside the canned laughter, his chin resting on his chest. "Fancy a coffee?" I said when I had run out of nails to chew. She's going to be ages, isn't she?
Nah, my doctor tells me I got to cut down on the donuts, and you know what happens if we go in the good donut place.
I picked at a loose thread on my trousers. Want to play I Spy?
Are you kidding me?
I lay back in my seat with a sigh and listened to the rest of the comedy show, then to Gary's labored breathing as it slowed and became an occasional snore. The sky had begun to darken, an unfriendly iron grey. It was going to take hours to get back through the traffic. And then my phone rang.
Louisa, are you with Agnes? Her phone seems to be turned off. Can you get her for me?
I glanced out of the window to where Stephen Lipcott's studio light cast a yellow rectangle over the greying snow below.
She's just trying some things on, Mr. Gopnik. Let me run into the changing rooms and I'll get her to call you straight back.
The downstairs door was propped open with 2 pots of paint, as if in the middle of a delivery. I ran up the concrete steps and along the corridor until I reached the studio. There I stopped at the closed door, breathing hard. I gazed down at my phone, then up to the heavens. I did not want to walk in. I did not want irrefutable proof of what had been suggested at Thanksgiving. I pressed my ear against the door, trying to work out if it was safe to knock, feeling furtive, as if it were I who was at fault. But all I could hear was music and muffled conversation. With greater confidence, I knocked. A couple of seconds later, I tried and opened the door. Stephen Lipcott and Agnes were standing on the far side of the room with their backs to me, looking at a stack of canvases against the wall. He rested one hand on her shoulder, the other waving a cigarette towards one of the smaller canvases. The room smelt of smoke and turpentine and faintly of perfume.
"Well, why don't you bring me some other pictures of her?" he was saying. "If you don't feel it really represents her, then we should..."
"Louisa!" Agnes spun around and threw up a palm as if she were warding me off. "I'm sorry," I said, holding up my phone. It's Mr. Gopnik. He's trying to reach you."
"You shouldn't have come in here. Why didn't you knock?"
The colour had leached from her face. "I did. I'm sorry. I didn't have any way of..." It was as I was backing out of the door that I glimpsed the canvas. A child with blonde hair and wide eyes, half turned as if about to skip away, and with a sudden and inevitable clarity, I understood everything. The depression, the endless conversations with her mother, the endless toy and shoe purchases. Stephen stooped to pick it up.
"Look, just take that one with you if you want, and have a think about it."
"Shut up, Stephen!" He flinched as if unsure what had prompted her reaction. But that was what finally confirmed it.
"I'll meet you downstairs," I said, and I closed the door quietly behind me.
We drove back to the Upper East Side in silence. Agnes called Mr. Gopnik and apologised.
She hadn't realised her phone was off, a design fault. The thing was always shutting down without her doing it. She really needed a different one, yes, darling.
"We're headed back now."
"Yes, I know."
She did not look at me. In truth, I could barely look at her. My mind was humming, marrying up the events of the last months with what I now understood. When we finally reached home, I walked a few paces behind her through the lobby, but as we got to the lift, she swiveled, stared at the floor, and then turned back towards the door.
"Okay, come with me."
We sat in a dark, gilded hotel bar, the kind where I imagined rich Middle Eastern businessmen entertained their clients and waved away bar bills without looking. It was nearly empty. Agnes and I sat in a dimly lit corner booth, waiting as the server ostentatiously offloaded 2 vodka tonics and a pot of glossy green olives, trying and failing to catch Agnes's eye.
She's mine,
Agnes said as he walked away. I took a sip of my drink. It was ferociously strong, and I was glad. It felt useful to have something to focus on.
My daughter.
Her voice was tight, oddly furious.
She lives with my sister in Poland.
She's fine.
She was so young when I went that she barely remembers when her mama lived with her. And my sister is happy because she cannot have children. But my mother is very angry at me.
But I didn't tell him when I met him, okay? I was so happy that someone like him liked me. I didn't think for one minute we would be together. It was like a dream, you know? I thought I will just have this little adventure, and then my work visa will finish, and I will go back to Poland, and I will remember this thing always. And then everything happened so fast, and he leaves his wife for me. I couldn't think how to tell him. Every time I meet him, I think, this is the time. This is the time. And then when we are together, he tells me he doesn't want any more children. He is done, he says. He feels he has made the big mess with his own family, and he does not want to make it worse with step-families, half-brothers, half-sisters, all this business. He loves me, but the no-children thing is deal-breaker for him. So how can I tell him, then?
I leant forward so that nobody else could hear.
But this is batshit crazy, Agnes. You already have a daughter. And how can I tell him this now after 2 years? You think he will not think I am bad woman? You think he will not see this as terrible, terrible deceit? I have made huge problem for myself, Louisa. I know this. She took a swig of her drink. I think all the time, how I can fix this. But there is nothing to fix. I lied to him. For him, trust is everything. He would not forgive me. So is simple. This way, he is happy, I am happy. I can provide for everyone. I try to convince my sister to come to live in New York one day. Then I can see Sophia every day. But you must miss her terribly. Her jaw tightened. I am providing for her future. She spoke as if reading from a long-rehearsed mental list. Before our family, Dad not so much. My sister now lives in very good house. 4 bedrooms, everything new. Very nice area. Sophia will go to best school in Poland, play best piano. She will have everything. But no mother. Her eyes suddenly brimmed. No. I have to leave Leonard, or I have to leave her. So is my penance to live without her. Her voice cracked a little. I sipped my vodka. I didn't know what else to do. We both stared at our glasses. I am not a bad person, Louisa. I love Leonard very much. I know. I had this idea that maybe when we had been married, when we had been together a while, I could tell him. And he would be a little bit upset, but maybe he could come around. Or I could go backwards and forwards to Poland, you know? Or maybe she could come stay for a bit. But things just get so complicated. His family hates me so much. You know what would happen if they found out about her now. You know what would happen if Tabitha knew this thing about me? I could guess. I love him. I know you think many things about me, but I love him. He's a good man. Sometimes I find it very hard because he's working so much, and because nobody cares for me in his world. And I get so lonely, and maybe I do not always behave perfectly. But when I think of being without him, I cannot bear it. He is truly my soulmate. From first day, I knew this. She traced a pattern on the table with her slim finger. But then I think of my daughter, growing up for the next 10-15 years without me, and I... She let out a shuddering sigh, loud enough to draw the attention of the barman. I reached into my bag, and when I couldn't find a handkerchief, I passed her a cocktail napkin. When she looked up, there was a softness to her face. It was an expression I hadn't seen before, radiant with love and tenderness.
She is so beautiful, Louisa. She is nearly 4 years old now, and so clever, and so bright. She knows days of week, and she can point out countries on the globe, and she can sing. She knows where New York is. She can draw a line on map between Krakow and New York without anybody showing her. And every time I visit, she hangs on to me and says, "Why you have to go, Mama? I don't want you to go." And a little bit of my heart, it breaks. Oh, God, it breaks. Sometimes now I don't even want to see her, because the pain when I have to leave is... It is... Agnes hunched over her drink, her hand lifting mechanically to wipe the tears that fell silently onto the shiny table. I handed her another cocktail napkin. "Agnes," I said softly, "I don't know how long you could keep this up." She dabbed at her eyes, her head bowed. When she looked up, it was impossible to tell she had been crying. "We are friends, yes? Good friends." "Of course." She glanced behind her and leant forward over the table. "You and I, we are both immigrants. We both know it is hard to find your place in this world. You want to make your life better, work hard in a country that is not your own. You make new life, new friends, find new love. You get to become new person. But it's never a simple thing. Never without cost." I swallowed and pushed away a hot, angry image of Sam in his railway carriage. "I know this. Nobody gets everything. And we immigrants know this more than anybody else. You always have one foot in two places. You can never be truly happy because from the moment you leave, you are two selves. And wherever you are, one half of you is always calling to the other. This is our price, Louisa. This is the cost of who we are." She took a sip of her drink and then another. Then she took a deep breath and shook her hands out across the table, as if she were ridding herself of excess emotion through her fingertips. When she spoke again, her voice was steely. "You must not tell him. You must not tell him what you see today." "Agnes, I don't know how you can hide this forever. It's too big. It..." She reached out a hand and laid it on my arm. Her fingers closed firmly around my wrist. "Please. We are friends, yes?" I swallowed. There are no real secrets among the rich, it turns out. Just people paid to keep them. I walked up the stairs, this new burden unexpectedly heavy on my heart. I thought of a little girl across the world with everything but the things she wanted most in the world, and a woman who probably felt the same, even if she was only just beginning to realize it. I thought about calling my sister, the only person left with whom I might be able to discuss it, but knew, without speaking to her, what her judgment would be. She would no more have left Tom in another country than she would have cut off her own arm. I thought about Sam, and the bargains we make with ourselves to justify our choices. I sat in my room that evening until my thoughts hung low and black around my head, and I pulled out my phone. "Hey, Josh, is that office still open? But for, like, a drink instead of coffee?" Within 30 seconds, the answer pinged back. "Just say where and when, Louisa." Chapter 21. In the end, I met Josh at a dive bar he knew of Times Square. It was long and narrow, covered with photographs of boxes, and the floor was tacky underfoot. I wore black jeans and scraped my hair into a ponytail. Nobody looked up as I squeezed my way past the middle-aged men and autographed pictures of flyweights and men whose necks were wider than their heads. He was seated at a tiny table at the end of the bar in a waxed dark brown jacket, the kind you buy to look like you belong in the countryside. When he saw me, his smile was sudden and infectious and made me briefly glad that someone, uncomplicated, was pleased to see me in a world that felt impossibly messy. "How are you doing?" He stood and looked like he wanted to step forward and hug me, but something, perhaps the circumstances of our last meeting, prevented him. He touched my arm instead. "I've had a bit of a day, a bit of a week, actually, and I really need a friendly face to have a drink or two with. And guess what? Yours was the first name I pulled out of my New York hat. What do you want? Bear in mind they do about 6 drinks here. Vodka tonic?
I'm pretty sure that's one of them. He was back within minutes, with a bottled beer for himself and a vodka tonic for me. I had shed my coat and was oddly nervous to be opposite him. So, this is a week of yours. What happened? I took a sip of my drink. It sat too comfortably on top of the one I'd had that afternoon. I found out something today. It's kind of knocked me sideways. I can't tell you what it is, not because I don't trust you, but because it's so big that it would affect all sorts of people. And I don't know what to do about it. I shifted in my seat. I think I just need to kind of swallow it and learn how not to let it give me indigestion. Does that make sense? So I was hoping I could see you and have a couple of drinks and hear a bit about your life. A nice life without big dark secrets. Assuming you don't have any big dark secrets. And remind myself that life can be normal and good. But I really don't want you to try and get me to talk about mine. Like if I happen to drop my defences and stuff. He put his hand on his heart. Louisa, I do not want to know about your thing. I'm just happy to see you. I honestly would tell you if I could. I have no curiosity about this gigantic life-altering secret whatsoever. You're safe with me. He took a swig of his drink and smiled his perfect smile at me. And for the first time in 2 weeks, I felt a tiny bit less lonely. 2 hours later, the bar was overheated and 3 deep. Exhausted tourists marvelling at $3 beers and regulars rammed along its narrow length. The vast majority focused on a boxing match on the TV in the corner. They cried out in unison at a swift uppercut and roared as one when their man, his face pulped and misshapen, went down against the ropes. Josh was the only man in the whole place not watching it, leaning quietly over his bottle of beer, his eyes on mine. I, in turn, was slumped over the table and telling him at length the story of Trina and Edwina on Christmas Day, one of the few stories I could legitimately share. Along with that of Grandad's stroke, the story of the grand piano, I said it was for Agnes's niece, and in case I sounded too gloomy, my lovely upgrade from New York to London. I don't know how many vodkas I'd had by then. Josh tended to magic them in front of me before I'd realised I was done with the last one. But some distant part of me was aware that my voice had acquired a weird sing-song quality, sliding up and down, not always in accordance with what I was saying. "Well, that's cool, right?" he said, when I reached Dad's speech about happiness. I may have made it a little more Lifetime movie than it had been. In my latest version, Dad had become Atticus Finch, delivering his closing speech to the courtroom in To Kill a Mockingbird. "It's all good," Josh went on. "He just wants her to be happy. When my cousin Tim came out to my uncle, he didn't speak to him for, like, a year." "They're so happy," I said, stretching my arms across the table, just so I could feel the cool bits on my skin, trying not to mind that it was sticky. "It's great. It really is." I took another sip of my drink. "It's like you look at them both together and you're so glad because, you know, Trina's been on her own for 1 million years, but honestly, it would be really nice if they could just be a teeny bit less glowy and radiant around each other, like not always gazing into each other's eyes, or doing that secret smile which is about the private shared jokes. Or the one that means they've just had really, really great sex. And maybe Trina could just stop sending me pictures of the two of them together. Or text messages about every amazing thing Eddie says or does, which apparently is pretty much anything she says or does. Ah, come on. They're newly in love, right? People do that stuff." "I never did." "Did you do that stuff? Seriously, I have never sent anyone pictures of me kissing someone. If I sent a picture of me snuggling with a boyfriend to Trina, she would have reacted like I'd sent her a dick pic. I mean, this is the woman who found all displays of emotion disgusting. Then it's the first time she's been in love. And she'll be delighted to get the next picture you send her of you being nauseatingly happy with your boyfriend." He looked like he was laughing at me. "Maybe not the dick pic." "You think I'm a terrible person." "I don't think you're a terrible person. Just a fairly refreshed one." I groaned. "I know. I'm a terrible person. I'm not asking them not to be happy, just to be a teeny bit sensitive to those of us who might not be just at this..." I'd run out of words. Josh had settled back in his chair and was now watching me. "Ex-boyfriend," I said, my voice slurring slightly. "He's now an ex-boyfriend." He raised his eyebrows. "Whoa! Quite a couple of weeks, then. Oh, man. I rested my forehead on the table. You have no idea.
I was conscious of a silence falling gently between us. I wondered, briefly, if I might just take a little power nap right there. It felt so nice. The sounds of the boxing match briefly receded. My forehead was only a little bit wet. And then I felt his hand on mine.
Okay, Louisa, I think it's time we got you out of here.
I said goodbye to all the nice people on my way out, high-fiving as many as I could. Some seemed to miss my hand. Idiots. For some reason, Josh kept apologizing out loud. I think maybe he was bumping into them as we walked. He put my jacket on me when we got to the door, and I got the giggles, because he couldn't get my arms into my sleeves, and when he did, it was the wrong way round, like a straitjacket.
I give up, he said eventually. Just wear it like that.
I heard someone shout,
Take a little water with it, lady!
I am a lady, I exclaimed. An English lady. I am Louisa Clark the First, aren't I, Joshua? I turned to face them and air-punched. I was leaning against the wall of photographs and brought a few clattering down on top of me.
We're going,
Josh said, raising his hands towards the barman. Someone started shouting. He was still apologizing to everyone. I told him it wasn't good to apologize. Will had taught me that. You had to hold your head up. And suddenly we were out in the brisk cold air. Then before I knew it, I tripped on something and suddenly I was on the icy pavement, my knees smacking onto the hard concrete. I swore.
Oh, boy, said Josh,
who had his arm firmly round my waist and was hauling me upright.
I think we need to get you some coffee.
He smelt so nice. He smelt like Will had, expensive, like the men's section of a posh department store. I put my nose against his neck and inhaled as we staggered along the pavement. You smell lovely.
Thank you very much.
Very expensive.
Good to know.
I might lick you.
If it makes you feel better.
I licked him. His aftershave didn't taste as nice as it smelt, but it was kind of nice to lick someone.
It does make me feel better, I said with some surprise.
It really does.
Okay. Here's the best part to get a cab.
He maneuvered himself so that he was facing me and put his hands on my shoulders. Around us, Times Square was blinding and dizzying, a glittering neon circus, its leviathan images looming down at me with impossible brightness. I turned slowly, gazing up at the lights and feeling like I might fall over. I went round and round while they blurred, then staggered slightly. I felt Josh catch me.
I can put you in a cab home because I think you might need to sleep this off. Or we can walk to mine and get some coffee down you. Your choice.
It was after 1 in the morning, yet he had to shout to be heard over the noise of the people around us. He was so handsome in his shirt and jacket, so clean-cut and crisp-looking. I liked him so much. I turned in his arms and blinked at him. It would have been helpful if he'd stopped swaying.
That's very kind of you, he said.
Did I say that all out loud?
Yep.
Sorry.
But you really are terrifically handsome. Like American handsome. Like an actual movie star.
Josh?
Yeah?
I think I might sit down. My head has gone kind of fuzzy. I was halfway to the ground when I felt him sweep me up again.
And there we go.
I really want to tell you the thing. But I can't tell you the thing.
Then don't tell me the thing.
You'd understand. I know you would. You know, you look so like someone I loved. Really loved.
Did you know that?
You look just so like him.
That's nice to know.
It is nice. He was terrifically handsome.
Just like you.
Movie star handsome.
Did I say that already?
He died. Did I tell you he died?
I'm sorry for your loss, but I think we need to get you out of here.
He walked me down 2 blocks, hailed a cab, and with some effort helped me in. I fought my way upright on the back seat and held onto his sleeve. He was half in, half out of the taxi door.
Where to, lady?
The driver looked behind him. I looked at Josh.
Can you stay with me?
Sure. Where are we going? I saw the wary glance of the driver in his rearview mirror. A television blared from the back of his seat and a television studio audience burst into applause. Outside, everyone started to honk their horns at once. The lights were too bright. New York was suddenly too loud, too everything.
I don't know. Your house? I said. I can't go back, not yet.
I looked at him and felt suddenly tearful.
Do you know, I have two legs in two places.
He tilted his head towards me. His face was kind. Louisa Clark, somehow that doesn't surprise me. I let my head rest on his shoulder and felt his arm slide gently around me. I woke to the sound of a phone ringing, shrill and insistent, the blessed relief of it stopping, then a man's voice murmuring, the welcome bitter smell of coffee. I shifted, trying to lift my head from the pillow. The resulting pain through my temples was so intense and unforgiving that I let out a little animal sound, like a dog whose tail had just been trapped in a door. I closed my eyes, took a breath, then opened them again. This was not my bed. It was still not my bed when I opened them a third time. This indisputable fact was enough to prompt me to attempt to lift my head again, this time ignoring the thumping pain long enough to focus. Nope, this was definitely not my bed. This was also not my bedroom. In fact, it was no bedroom I had ever seen before. I took in the clothes, men's clothes, folded neatly over the back of a chair, the television in the corner, the desk and the wardrobe, and became aware of the voice growing nearer. And then the door opened and Josh walked in, fully suited, holding a mug in one hand, his phone pressed to his ear with the other. He caught my eye, raised an eyebrow, and placed the mug on the bedside table, still talking. Yeah, there's been a problem with the subway. I'm going to grab a cab and I'll be there in 20. Sure. No problem. No, she's on that already. I pushed myself upright, discovering, as I did so, that I was in a man's T-shirt. The ramifications of this took a couple of minutes to seep in, and I felt the blush start from somewhere around my chest.
No, we already talked about that yesterday. He's got all the paperwork ready to go.
He turned away, and I wriggled back down so that the duvet was around my neck. I was wearing knickers. That was something.
Yeah, it'll be great. Yeah, lunch sounds good.
Josh rang off and shoved his phone into his pocket.
Good morning. I was just going to get you a side order of Advil. Want me to find you a couple?
I'm afraid I have to go.
Go?
My mouth tasted rank, as dry as if it had been lightly powdered. I opened and closed it a couple of times, noting it made a faintly disgusting smacking sound.
To work. It's Friday.
Oh, God, what time is it?
6:45. I have to shoot, already running late. Will you be okay to let yourself out?
He rummaged in a drawer and withdrew a blister pack, which he placed beside me. There, that should help. I pushed my hair back from my face. It was slightly damp with sweat and astonishingly matted. What happened?
We can talk about it later. Drink your coffee.
I took a sip obediently. It was strong and restorative. I suspected I would need another six. Why am I in your T-shirt?
He grinned. That would be the dance.
The dance? My stomach lurched. He stooped and kissed my cheek. He smelled of soap and cleanliness and citrus and all things wholesome. I was aware that I was giving off hot waves of stale sweat and alcohol and shame.
It was a fun night. Hey, just make sure you give the door a really good slam when you leave, okay? Sometimes it doesn't catch properly. I'll call you later.
He saluted from the doorway, turned and was gone, patting his pockets as if to reassure himself of something he left.
Hold on, where am I?
I yelled a minute later, but he was already gone.
I was in Soho, it turned out.
One giant, angry traffic jam away from where I was meant to be. I caught the subway from Spring Street to 59th Street, trying not to sweat gently into yesterday's crumpled shirt, and grateful for the small mercy that I was not in my usual glittery evening clothes. I had never really understood the term grubby until that morning. I could remember almost nothing from the previous evening, and what I did remember came to me in unpleasant, hot flashbacks. Me sitting down in the middle of Times Square. Me licking Josh's neck. I had actually licked his neck. What was that about dancing? If I hadn't been hanging onto the subway pole for dear life, I would have held my head in my hands. Instead, I closed my eyes, lurched my way through the stations, shifted to avoid the backpacks and the grumpy commuters locked into their earphones, and tried not to throw up. Just get through today, I told myself. If life had taught me one thing, it was that the answers would come soon enough. I was just opening the door to my room when Mr. Gopnik appeared. He was still dressed in his workout gear, unusual for him after seven, and lifted a hand when he saw me as if he had been trying to locate me for some time.
Ah, Louisa.
I'm sorry, I'd like to talk with you in my study.
Now.
Of course you would, I thought. Of course. He turned and walked back up the corridor. I cast an anguished look at my room, which held my clean clothes, deodorant and toothpaste. I thought longingly about a second coffee. But Mr. Gopnik was not the kind of man you kept waiting. I glanced down at my phone, then jogged after him. I walked into the study to find him already seated. I'm really sorry I was 10 minutes late. I'm not normally late. I just had to... Mr. Gopnik was behind his desk, his expression unreadable. Agnes was on the upholstered chair by the coffee table in her workout gear. Neither of them asked me to sit down. Something in the atmosphere made me feel suddenly horribly sober. Is everything okay?
I'm hoping you can tell me.
I had a call from my personal account manager this morning.
Your what?
The man who handles my banking operations. I wondered if you could explain this. He pushed a piece of paper towards me. It was a bank statement with the totals blacked out. My eyesight was a little blurry, but just one thing was visible. A trail of figures. $500 a day under cash withdrawals. It was then that I noticed Agnes's expression. She was staring fixedly at her hands, her mouth compressed into a thin line. Her gaze flickered towards me and away again. I stood, a fine trickle of sweat running down my back. He told me something very interesting. Apparently, in the run-up to Christmas, a considerable sum of money was removed from our joint bank account. It was removed day by day from a nearby ATM, in amounts that were, perhaps, designed not to be noticed. He picked it up because they have anti-fraud software, designed to identify strange patterns of use in any of our bank cards, and this was flagged up as unusual. Obviously, this was a little concerning, so I asked Agnes, and she told me it wasn't anything to do with her. So I asked Ashok to provide the CCTV for the days concerned, and my security people married it up with the times of the withdrawals. And it turns out, Louisa... Here he looked at me directly. The only person going in and out of the building at those times was you. My eyes widened. Now, I could go to the banks concerned and ask them to provide the CCTV from their ATMs at the times the amount was taken, but I'd rather not put them to that trouble. So really, I wanted to know whether you could explain what was going on here, and why almost $10,000 was removed from our joint account. I looked at Agnes, but she was still looking away from me. My mouth had dried even more than it had that morning. I had to do some Christmas shopping for Agnes.
You have a card to do that.
Which clearly shows which shops you've been in, and you provide the receipts for all the purchases, which up to now, I gather from Michael, you have done. But cash? Cash is rather less transparent. Do you have the receipts for this shopping?
No.
And can you tell me what you bought?
I... No.
So what has happened to the money, Louisa?
I couldn't speak. I swallowed, and then I said... I don't know.
You don't know?
I didn't steal anything. I felt the color rising to my cheeks.
So is Agnes lying?
No.
Louisa, Agnes knows that I would give her anything she wanted. To be frank, she could spend 10 times that in a day and I wouldn't bat an eyelid. So she has no reason to sneak around, withdrawing cash sums from the nearest ATM. So I'm asking you again, what happened to the money?
I felt flushed, panicky, and then Agnes looked up at me. Her face was a silent plea.
Louisa.
Perhaps I might have taken it. You might have taken it.
For shopping. Not for me. You can check my room. You can check my bank account.
You spent $10,000 on shopping. Shopping for what?
Just bits and pieces.
He lowered his head briefly as if he were trying to control his temper. Bits and pieces, he repeated slowly.
Louisa, you realize your being in this household is a matter of trust.
I do, Mr. Kopnik, and I take that very seriously.
You have access to the most inner workings of this household. You have keys, credit cards, intimate knowledge of our routines. You are well rewarded for that, because we understand this is a position of responsibility, and we rely on you not to betray that responsibility.
Mr. Gopnik, I love this job. I wouldn't. I cast an anguished look at Agnes, but she was still staring down. One of her hands I saw was holding the other, her fingernail digging deep into the flesh of the ball of her thumb.
You really can't explain what has happened to that money.
I didn't steal it. He looked at me intently for a moment, as if waiting for something. When it didn't come, his expression hardened.
This is disappointing, Louisa. I know Agnes is very fond of you, and feels you have been very helpful to her, but I cannot have someone in my household whom I do not trust.
Leonard, Agnes began, but he held up a hand.
No, darling, I've been through this before. I'm sorry, Louisa, but your employment is terminated with immediate effect.
What?
You will be given an hour to clear your room. You will leave a forwarding address with Michael, and he will be in touch regarding whatever is owed to you. I would take this opportunity to remind you of the non-disclosure element of your contract. The details of this conversation will go no further. I hope you can see that this is for your benefit as much as ours.
The color had drained from Agnes's face.
No, Leonard. You can't do this.
I'm not discussing this further. I have to go to work. Louisa, your hour starts now.
He stood. He was waiting for me to leave the room.
I emerged from the study with my head spinning. Michael was waiting for me, and it took me a couple of seconds to grasp that he was not there to see if I was okay, but to escort me to my room. That from now on, I really was not trusted in this house.
I walked silently down the corridor, vaguely conscious of Ilaria's stunned face at the kitchen door, the sound of impassioned conversation somewhere at the other end of the apartment. I couldn't see Nathan anywhere. As Michael stood in the doorway, I pulled my case from under my bed and began to pack, messily, chaotically, pulling out drawers, hauling things in as quickly as I could, conscious that I was working against some capricious clock. My brain hummed. Shock and outrage tempered by the need not to forget anything. Had I left laundry in the laundry room? Where were my trainers? And then 20 minutes later, I was done. All my belongings were packed into a suitcase. A holdall and a large checked shopping bag.
Here, I'll take that, said Michael, reaching for my wheelie case, as he saw me struggling to get 3 bags to the bedroom door.
It took me a second to realize this was less an act of kindness than efficiency.
iPad, he said. Work phone, credit card.
I handed them over along with the door keys, and he put them into his pocket. I walked along the hallway, still struggling to believe this was happening. Ilaria was standing in the kitchen doorway, her apron on, her plump hands pressed together. As I passed her, I glanced sideways, expecting her to curse me in Spanish or to give me the kind of withering look that women of her age reserve for alleged thieves. But instead, she stepped forward and silently touched my hand. Michael turned away as if he hadn't seen, and then we were at the front door. He passed me the handle of my case.
"Goodbye, Louisa," he said, his expression unreadable. "Good luck."
I stepped out, and the huge mahogany door closed firmly behind me. I sat in the diner for 2 hours. I was in shock. I couldn't cry. I couldn't rage. I just felt paralyzed. I thought at first that Agnes would sort this out. She would find a way to convey to her husband that he was wrong. We were friends, after all. So I sat and waited for Michael to appear, looking slightly awkward, ready to pull my cases back to the lavery. I gazed at my mobile phone, waiting for a text message. "Louisa, there has been terrible misunderstanding." But none came.
When I realised it probably wasn't going to come, I thought about simply heading back to the UK. But to do so would wreak havoc on Trina's life. The last thing she and Tom needed was for me turfing them out of the flat. I couldn't return to Mum and Dad's. It wasn't just the soul-destroying thought of moving back to Stortford. But I thought I might die if I had to go home as a failure twice. The first time broken after drunkenly falling from a building, the second fired from the job I had loved. And of course I could no longer stay with Sam. I cradled my coffee cup with fingers that still trembled, and saw that I had effectively boxed myself out of my own life. I considered calling Josh, but I didn't feel it was appropriate to ask him if I could move in, given I wasn't sure we'd even had a first date. And if I did find accommodation, what was I going to do? I had no job. I didn't know if Mr. Gopnik would revoke my work permit. Presumably that only existed as long as I worked for him. Worst of all, I was haunted by the way he had looked at me. His expression of utter disappointment and faint contempt when I had failed to come up with a satisfactory answer. His quiet approval had been one of the many small satisfactions of my life there. That a man of such stature had thought that I was doing a good job had boosted my confidence, had left me feeling capable, professional, in a way I hadn't since looking after Will. I wanted so badly to explain myself to him, to regain his goodwill. But how could I? I saw Agnes's face, eyes wide, pleading. She would call, wouldn't she? Why hadn't she called? "You want a refill, sweetheart?" I looked up at the middle-aged waitress with tangerine-coloured hair holding the coffee jug. She eyed my belongings like she had seen this scenario a million times before. "Just got here." "Not exactly." I tried to smile, but it came out as a kind of grimace. She poured the coffee and stooped, lowering her voice. "My cousin runs a hostel in Bensonhurst if you're stuck for somewhere to stay. There are cards over by the till. It ain't pretty, but it's cheap and it's clean. Call sooner rather than later. You know what I'm saying? Places fill up." She put a hand briefly on my shoulder and walked on to the next customer. That small act of kindness almost did for my composure. For the first time I felt overwhelmed, crushed by the knowledge that I was alone in a city that no longer welcomed me. I didn't know what I was supposed to do now that my bridges were apparently pushing out thick black smoke on two continents. I tried to picture myself explaining to my parents what had happened, but found myself once again butting up against the vast wall of Agnes's secret. Could you tell even one person without the truth slowly creeping out? My parents would be so outraged on my behalf that I couldn't put it past Dad not to ring Mr. Gopnik, just to set him straight about his deceitful wife. And what if Agnes denied everything? I thought about Nathan's words. Ultimately, we were staff, not friends. What if she lied and said I had stolen the money? Wouldn't that make things worse? For perhaps the first time since I had arrived in New York, I